So today, for the last lecture of this class, I want to have a little bit of fun and talk about some of the interesting results and open questions in the field of strong gravity. So we're not going to go into any depth on any of these subjects, but just sort of give a broad overview of the things people are thinking about and things people have figured out, and sort of open questions. So let's begin by talking about compact object mergers. So of course, you know, with the recent breakthroughs in gravitational wave astronomy, that's sort of become one of the most exciting things in the field and in physics in general. So the main sources that ground-based gravitational wave detectors like LIGO were built to go after were the mergers of compact objects, that is black holes and neutron stars. So let's talk a little bit about the different types of these compact object mergers and their different characteristic phenomena that they exhibit. So yesterday, Juan mentioned how if we want to actually search for these gravitational wave signals, which are in general very weak and can be buried in the noise, sort of the optimal way to do that is with match filtering. So we actually want to have a template for the waveforms that we're expecting and use that to search in our data and actually pull out the signals. So that kind of emphasizes the sort of importance of having a good theoretical understanding of what the waveforms will look like, for example, from two black holes merging. And of course, once we actually detect something, we know that there's a signal in the data. We also want to do parameter estimation, figure out what the masses are of the individual objects. We want to see if they're consistent with GR or not, and do astronomy and fundamental science with it. So let's start with binary black hole mergers. So in some sense, this is the simplest kind of system. We just have to solve this equation right here. And as far as we know, this is a fundamental equation that will tell us everything about what happens when two black holes come together and merge and what the gravitational wave signal is. Of course, in practice, actually solving this is difficult. And you have to combine a number of different techniques that we've sort of touched on in the class. So if we look at the gravitational wave signal from a binary black hole merger, we can sort of divide it into several stages. One, we have essentially like something like a sine wave with slowly increasing amplitude and frequency. Then the black holes will get closer and closer together. At some point, they'll start to move very rapidly and go to high frequencies, and you'll form a common horizon between the two black holes. And then this distorted common horizon will rapidly exhibit damped oscillations. So you can sort of divide it into these three stages. The end spiral the merger, and then the ring down. And we can sort of use different techniques for these different stages. So for the end spiral, we can use post-Newtonian expansion. Was mentioned earlier this week. For the merger, that's when things become very nonlinear. space time is very strongly curved and highly dynamical, and that's really where you have to solve the nonlinear equations. So there, the usual technique is to use full numerical solutions or numerical relativity. And then the ring down, you know, once these oscillations are dying down, that should be described by black hole perturbation theory, which we talked about earlier in the week. So, you know, in theory, you know, if you have a full numerical solution, it should describe all these different regimes. But in practice, you know, it's difficult, sort of too computationally expensive to do very long time scales. So you can't go, you know, sort of arbitrary back, far back in spiral. You know, of course, you can do the ring down or something like that, but it's also good to understand it from a perturbative theory. Yeah, and so the post-Newtonian, so we'll just say a couple words about post-Newtonian. So the idea is to expand Einstein's equations about the Newtonian solution, doing basically essentially a Taylor series in V over C. And by sort of the Virial theorem, we know that this should also be the same order as M over R. So if we call this epsilon, we're expanding this parameter epsilon. And just a little bit of terminology, people will say that, you know, this is the first post-Newtonian term, or it's like the 3.5 post-Newtonian term. And so that refers to this, basically the power of epsilon that term comes in. So for example, you know, if you have a 2.5 PN term, that means it's V to the fifth power. Yeah, so for example, for two-body motion, here's the PN expansion for the acceleration. So leading order, just have Newton's law, or that as a vector. So, yeah, just the acceleration we have from Newton's theory, and then we'll have a series of post-Newtonian corrections. Just as an example, I'll write down the first one here. Okay, and here, this mu is the so-called reduced mass, which is this combination of the two masses divided by the total mass squared. And so, you know, this is the term that gives you, you know, for an eccentric orbit, this advance in the periastron value, for example, that, you know, we measured for Mercury. And it's actually only this 2.5 turn that has the leading order radiation reaction. So in the tutorial and also in the third homework, you know, you'll work out what happens if you just take a Newtonian orbit and plug in this leading order radiation reaction, the fact that the gravitational waves are carrying away energy and angular momentum, and because that's kind of a secular effect that continuously causes the orbit to shrink. That's kind of the, you know, the most important effect here, and then you can calculate higher order corrections, and so on. But if you just work out how that leading order effect changes the frequency as a function of time, you get this for the time derivative of the frequency.
Is this the type of calculation they did when they, for the observations of the
Pulsars?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so this just tells you how the frequency of the orbit increases as a function of time. And you'll notice it depends on this script m, which is the reduced mass to the 3/5 power times the total mass. And this is called the chirp mass. And it's actually, you know, what sort of LIGO measures the best from these in-spiral gravitational waveforms. So, you know, if you remember these sort of spectrograms, we have time frequency. It's basically what sets the curvature of this. And so, you know, for example, for the binary neutron star event, they actually measured this quantity to several digits. But then once you try to divide that into the total mass or the individual masses, then the errors get larger. But this combination itself is measured very accurately. And of course, the gravitational wave signal is just going to be sort of twice the orbital frequency, you know, for equal mass. Yeah, and so, you know, it's still an active area of research to basically calculate these higher order terms. As you can imagine, if it's this complicated at first order, they get sort of get exponentially more complicated as you go to higher orders. So sort of the state of the art for the compact object merger scenario is 4PN, and people are working on 5PN corrections. You know, though in some sense, this Taylor series sort of is probably only an asymptotic series, right? You know, if we want to study a merger, it's going to go to some finite value of V over C. So it's not clear that at some finite value, adding more terms will always help you. But so far, at least for this particular problem, it's post-Newtonian seems to do quite well, and each term sort of makes them more accurate. In addition to the sort of the traditional approaches for doing this expansion, people have also sort of more recently figured out how to do that using effective field theory techniques. So basically, you can calculate these terms using sort of Feynman diagrams. You know, you're not doing quantum mechanics, but it's still you can sort of import all that technology from particle physics. But so, you know, eventually, once we get to the, you know, once these two objects get close enough, the velocities will start getting higher. We expect this post-Newtonian to break, this post-Newtonian expansion to be less accurate.
Highest orders in perturbation. I mean, even you can go like even higher in that perturbation. Like.
So far people have only calculated up to the fourth.
Yeah, but if they reach order. Like 4,000. Would that like be enough to like the whole merger, or maybe not?
Well, yeah, I don't think. I mean, at some point you want to switch over to having a perturbed black hole, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, I mean, I think it has to break down at some point. Mm-hmm. But also, like I was saying, I mean, you're expanding in V over C, right?
Yeah.
But you're not going to sort of arbitrarily like it, V over C
right.
is becoming sort of half or something.
A number, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, so for the merger, need full solutions. We can compute those numerically. So sort of throughout this class, you mentioned some of the ingredients you need to sort of successfully do this. One of them is you need, you know, a well-posed initial value formulation of the Einstein equations. In class, we talked about one of those, the generalized harmonic. There's other ones, like one that looks very similar is called Z4. And the homework, you worked out one called the BSSN equations. And there are other ones. But yeah, so having a well-posed formulation of the Einstein equations is essential. But you also need some other ingredients. So you have to have control over these constraint violating modes. So we also talked briefly about one way to do that using this constraint damping. That's basically so that these, you don't have introduce sort of extra unphysical modes that grow exponentially and sort of spoil the accuracy of your solution. We talked about the initial data problem. So, you know, both, you know, also need some way to numerically solve the constraint equations at the initial time. And you don't just want a solution, you want something that sort of represents your astrophysical system as well as possible in the sense of, you know, if you want a quasi-circular system, you want to, you know, not introduce small eccentricities into your orbit, or if you tune those away by successively iterating or do other things like, you know, control this so-called junk gravitational radiation, things like that. You also need to resolve the disparate length scales that are in the system. So, you know, in a binary merger, we have a number of different scales. You know, sort of the smallest one would be the size of the individual black holes. And then, you know, much larger than that, you know, larger than that, we have sort of the orbital scale. And then much larger than that, we sort of have the distance to the wave zone where we actually want to extract the gravitational waves so we can compare with the signals that we see. So distance to the observer. So there's a number of, you know, so whenever you have this sort of hierarchy of scales and a numerical problem, that is, you know, makes it difficult. So one technique people use is this adaptive mesh refinement. So you put more resolution in different places depending on the scales you want to resolve. People also use spectral techniques for these problems.
Do you also change like your time step when you're closer to the merger because stuff is like more like faster, or do you just leave time step like uniform over time?
Yeah, so basically, I mean, you can probably guess what speed information propagates in an Einstein equations. It's the speed of light, right? So you basically always have to resolve that scale. So basically, you know, you always need like dx over, you basically need, you know, dt to be dx times some number that's less than one in geometric units. Yeah. Yeah, and so, and the last thing that we need is some way to handle the black hole singularities. Because, you know, inside their black holes, the curvature is blowing up, and Einstein's theory is beginning to break down. So there are a couple different techniques for this. One is called excision. So last week we talked about how we can define this concept of an apparent horizon at any given time. And you know, we can search for that by basically using some flow method or solving an elliptic equation to look for these surfaces where the outward null expansion is zero. And so what those surfaces mean is basically at the surface or inside a little bit, information is only propagating into that surface. It's not propagating outward. So it's perfectly fine to just not evolve some region inside that grid because you just sort of need ingoing information there. So that's one technique. There's another one called using punctures. Or basically, you sort of compactify your singularity so it's sort of infinitely far away. And you have like a coordinate singularity inside the black hole. But again, turns out not to bother things because it's sort of causally disconnected from outside. Yeah, so it was only in 2005 that people sort of first solved this binary black hole problem. But since then, there's been a lot of activity and a lot of like new results in the field. So at this point, these binary black hole merger simulations have become pretty routine, and people have started to map out the parameter space. You know, there's still more research, more efforts being put in to push it to more disparate mass ratios or very high black hole spins or things like that. So maybe just quickly mention like one or two of the new results that have come out of studying that.
How are like usually the boundary conditions you set for the binary merger? Are they like, do you like really take care to make them like constraint preserving so that the ingoing modes you have there don't like destroy your simulation, or you just say like, oh, everything's like flat far away?
So there's a couple different ways you can do the outer boundary conditions. One technique is to actually use a compactified coordinate, so you can actually have spatial infinity as a point on your grid. You know, of course, you're not gonna resolve anything sort of near that, but then you can just impose exactly Minkowski. Another would be to, just have your boundary at some finite distance but far away. And then depending on whether it's sort of in causal contact with the part of your simulation you care about, then you also want to worry about whether or not you know, you sort of have any incoming constraint violating modes or radiation or something at that boundary. So we have to look at what that, what those conditions would translate into for your evolution variables. Yeah, so one interesting thing about binary black hole mergers is that they can actually produce what's called a kick or recoil on the final black hole. And that's because, you know, gravitational waves can also carry away linear momentum. So, you know, when these things are orbiting, if you have sort of anisotropic beaming of gravitational radiation that can actually carry away linear momentum in some direction, and then the final remnant object has to have the, you know, opposite momentum just by conservation. So that means the final black hole can have, you know, some velocity in the center of mass frame. And so it's sort of exactly how big a kick depends on how this how gravitational radiation is beamed, especially in sort of the last phase of the merger where things are no longer just, you know, going around in a circle basically and averaging out to zero. So for example, for non-spinning black holes, if you look at the maximum kick you can get as a function of mu, this reduced mass. When you have equal mass, this can be a quarter. And in that case, there's no kick for the non-spinning black holes. And then it'll reach some maximum around mu of 0.2, and then it'll start to decrease again as you go to more disparate mass ratios. Because if the one object is much smaller than the other, then it's not really going to have that much effect in the final object. But for the non-spinning case, you can sort of reach recoil velocities of something like 250 kilometers per second, you know, which is pretty fast, but not that fast compared to the speed of light. But one interesting thing that sort of came out a few years after people started to get these binary black hole merger calculations working was that you could actually get much higher kick. So if instead of having non-spinning black holes, you have spins that are in opposite directions and actually point in the orbital plane. This is the orbital plane. So that's the so-called super kick configuration. And there are the recoil velocities. You can go up to something like 4,000 kilometers per second. So this might be astrophysically relevant, especially for the case of supermassive black hole mergers. Because we think, you know, when galaxies merge, eventually the black holes, supermassive black holes in their centers can find their way and merge together. But if they develop a kick velocity afterwards, they can actually get ejected from the center of the galaxy.
How long would it take to leave the galaxy? I mean, because it is fast, but it's still a long time, right, to leave the galaxy?
Yeah, but if we're talking about sort of cosmological time scales. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is that we could now observe galaxies that don't have a massive black hole inside.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, this. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So these merger simulations can tell you what the gravitational wave signal looks like from the merger, what the mass and spin of the final remnant is. What the sort of amplitude of these quasi-neural modes would be. So The last one we mentioned here was black hole perturbation theory. So that sort of sets the highest frequency that you'll see in one of these mergers will be set by the sort of quasi-normal mode ringing of the black hole. So also just mention in a couple sentences that, and sort of to combine all these different ingredients and also to be able to, interpolate a waveform template to sort of different parameters than you did a simulation for or things like that. People use a number of different techniques. One is called the effective one body approach, or EOB. So the idea is to map your binary spacetime to a single, sort of perturbed black hole spacetime, where you have some effective Hamiltonian and so forth, and use that to compute gravitational waveforms. But in essence, you can basically think of it as a way to interpolate or basically a fitting formula that you can add ingredients to, both the post-Newtonian and the black hole perturbation theory. So you can sort of add all the physics but then also have free parameters which you just tune to, for example, a numerical simulation or things like that. And then it can produce waveforms for different values. And there are also a number of other ways people do that, just using phenomenological waveforms. Or people are now starting to use things like machine learning or something like that. Approaches that are sort of agnostic to the physics. If you see any of these presentations or papers by LIGO or something, they'll say, we used NR EOB SP something version 5 or something like that. But yeah, that's what they mean basically. Okay, so that's binary black hole mergers. So let's talk a little bit about binary neutron star mergers. So we've seen almost a dozen binary black hole mergers. And so far, we've seen one gravitational wave signal from a binary neutron star merger. That's GW170817. Binary neutron star mergers, now we can't get away with just solving the Einstein equations. We need some description for the matter. So the sort of simplest way to treat a neutron star is as a relativistic fluid. So in addition to the Einstein equations, we have the relativistic weather equations. So rho naught here is the rest mass density of our fluid, and u is just the four velocity of the fluid. So this is basically just tells us that we have conservation of our rest mass. And then the second equation, of course, is just the conservation of stress energy. And so, but with this particular form, the stress energy tensor for a fluid. So here, rho is the energy density as seen by an observer, and the rest frame of the fluid. So you can write it as this rest mass density plus this epsilon part, which is called the specific energy. And then P is the pressure. So basically we have six variables, right? We have rest mass density, epsilon, the pressure, and then, you know, three free components of the four velocity, because we can get the fourth one by normalization. But this only gives us five equations, right? We got one here and then four here. So we need one other relation. And that relation is basically something that tells us the pressure in terms of the other fluid variables. So you know, something that'll sort of be determined by the microphysics of the fluid. And that's called the equation of state. So if we're talking about neutron stars, and we're talking about sort of incredibly high densities, you know, something like 10 to the 15 grams per centimeter cubed. And so we don't really have access to these incredibly high densities in our terrestrial lab. So it's actually a big unknown how nuclear physics behaves at these. So we actually don't really know what the neutron star equation of state is. However, the idea is that maybe we can actually use gravitational wave observations of neutron stars to tell us, to figure out what this equation of state is, to tell us how nuclear matter behaves. So if we look at the leading order effect on the n-spiral of having matter, which you can calculate in post-Newtonian theory, for example. So let's write the phase of our gravitational wave as a function of frequency. So we have some prefactor involving the chert mass. Then we're going to have a series of terms. Of various post-Newtonian orders. So if we go all the way up to the to 5 PN, there'll be some contribution due to tidal effects. And so here X is just this new variable determined in terms of the frequency. So this tidal effect here so this tidal effect has this following term, this ratio of the masses. This term is just this term here, but switch the indices of 1 to 2. And then this lambda is the dimensionless tidal deformability parameter. So basically what it tells us is if we take our neutron star, put in an external gravitational field that has some tidal moment, EAB, then what is the induced quadrupole that the star will develop? So it's this proportionality here between the tidal moment and the induced quadrupole. And then I've just factored out this factor of mass to the fifth power. So it's just dimensionless. But essentially what this is telling us is that if you have like neutron stars instead of black holes, during the end spiral, the tidal field of one neutron star acting the other will cause it to develop an induced quadrupole, and that'll cause it to emit slightly more gravitational radiation, so the end spiral will happen a little bit faster. However, you can see it's a pretty high order post-Newtonian effect. As we just mentioned earlier, we don't even know all these other 5PN terms. So you might think, like, how do we have any chance of actually measuring this? There's some hope that basically the, prefactor in front of this term is going to be large. And that's basically because this is going to basically go like the radius over the mass to the fifth power. Because neutron stars are not quite as small as black holes, we might think, this is going to be sort of a, number of order six or something like that. And so the prefactor might be large enough to make this measurable. Though at least from this one event, we basically only have upper bounds on this. Yeah, so, just for comparison there, we have this compaction parameter, which is like the mass over the radius. We think for neutron stars, it's somewhere between 0.15 to 0.2. So of course, for a black hole, this would be sort of order 0.5. And just in certain terms of astrophysical units, this would correspond to a value of 0.17 for this compaction would correspond to a 1.4 solar mass star having a radius of 12 kilometers. Yeah, so of course for the merger, these other other matter effects will be very important. For example, in determining when these stars come together and collide, are they going to immediately collapse to a black hole, or will they create what's called a hypermassive neutron star? That's this longer-lived remnant where basically the star is supported by thermal pressure that you can develop from shock heating or things like that, and also the differential rotation. But then will eventually collapse to a black hole once it loses those. Or even if the sort of pressure support from the equation state is strong enough, one might even imagine forming a stable star afterwards. But the problem is basically that the merger of a neutron star happens at very high frequencies where instruments like LIGO are not very sensitive. If we look at this sensitivity curve as a function of frequency that Juan was drawing yesterday, so for LIGO noise curve, we have something like this, where the noise curve is going up rapidly. It's sort of a kilohertz level. The sweet spot is around 100 hertz. Then you have this noise wall due to like seismic noise and things like that at around 10 hertz. So for these binary black hole mergers, we have basically signals coming in like this, and they're merging in band at the where LIGO is very sensitive. Depending on how massive these are, we might just see sort of the last few orbits in the and then the merger. But for neutron stars, basically, we'll see many cycles in band, but then when the actual merger happens, it'll be at higher frequencies where there's not that much sensitivity. So that's why it's going to be harder to sort of detect these equation of state effects. However, you know, actually understanding them is important for connecting to all the subsequent electromagnetic transients that we saw after this one neutron star event, and hopefully we'll see after other ones, and basically determining when these stars come together, you know, how do they create a jet which might power a gamma ray burst? When these two stars collide, do they basically throw off or eject some small amount of this very neutron-rich material that's in the stars? That's thought to power these like optical infrared signals called kilonova. Basically, you have this, you know, basically rich neutron fluid that's expanding outwards. And at some point, you undergo what's called the R process, basically build up these very heavy elements that undergo radioactive decay. And so that might be actually where very heavy elements like gold and platinum come from, and also sort of the energy from these nuclear reactions can power optical signals that we see afterwards. But sort of to address all these questions, you know, you want to start going beyond just doing relativistic hydrodynamics and start adding things like magnetic fields, you know, radiation transport, which will tell you, you know, how neutrinos from your hot star that you form afterwards can carry off energy and cool the star, things like that. Yeah, and so like the last combination that I haven't mentioned yet is a black hole merging with a neutron star, a black hole neutron star merger. So, you know, so far we haven't, that we know of, observed a gravitational wave signal from that, but it's definitely another possibility. And so, you know, for the earlier InSpiral, it'll be similar to these cases, but sort of the interesting things will happen when the star starts to get close to the black hole, and then it may or may not get tidally disrupted, or the tidal forces of the black hole will cause the star to be pulled apart. So for black hole neutron star mergers, sort of the big question is, does this tidal disruption occur basically before or after you get to the sort of effect of innermost stable orbit of your system?
Where would be this merger in that graph of the light sensitivity? Mm-hmm. Like, where would it be? Like, would you see like the whole thing, or would it be similar to a neutron star case?
Yeah, so this highest frequency is kind of set, like as we said, by sort of the ringing of the final object, right? So it basically depends on how big the black hole is. But we definitely expect it to be probably bigger than a neutron star, so it's going to be merge at lower frequencies. If the black hole is very big, then it could be comparable to some of these other binary black hole mergers we've seen. Sort of conversely, if the black hole is very big compared to the neutron star, then it'll probably just swallow the neutron star whole. That would give us a merger gravitational wave signal, but it probably wouldn't give rise to an accretion disk. One way to get around that might be if the black hole is rapidly spinning. So, you know, from our study of Kerr in the first week, you can probably guess, you know, how spin could sort of enhance the accretion disk, right? You basically want it to point in the direction of the orbital angular momentum, so the sort of ISCO of the final black hole can move inwards. Yeah, so I also had some discussion about sort of beyond astrophysics applications, you know, things like questions of cosmic censorship, critical phenomena, things like that, ultra-relativistic collisions. But maybe since we just have a couple minutes left, just show you some basically animations from various topics, both these compact object mergers and sort of beyond astrophysics applications of strong gravity. Okay, so here is a binary black hole merger simulation. So you can see the black holes sort of orbiting each other, and these green blobs are the gravitational waves. So you can see them increasing in amplitude and frequency as the black holes get closer and closer together. And then finally they emerge and form this common horizon. And you get these very high frequency waves. So we know those are the quasi-normal mode ringings. You can calculate the frequency, those the real and imaginary part from black hole perturbation theory.
How long does it take a simulation like that to?
Yeah, like sort of days to weeks, depending on how long you want it to go back. So here's binary neutron star merger, showing you two of the different outcomes of the merger. So these two simulations use different equations of state to describe the neutron star. So you, the sizes you get are not that different, but the differences start sort of post-merger. So in the case on the left, after a little bit, it's going to collapse to a black hole.
Is that the energy density, or?
This is the, just the rest mass density. So you get a black hole, and then this guy just keeps on oscillating. So this will create these, you know, very high frequency gravitational waves, you know, at a few kilohertz, that would be difficult to detect with LIGO, but are there in theory. Here's another case of a merger, where actually this star undergoes what's called the one-arm mode instability, and it'll develop this funny wobble, where basically, even though the stars have equal mass, there's an instability to an m equals one perturbation that gives the star this funny wobble, which you can also see in the gravitational waves, but are quite weak. And here's black hole neutron star merger. So this is a case where we actually have some precession due to the black hole spin being misaligned. And then you can see the star being torn apart and developing this accretion disk. And actually, get some interesting effects where the matter sort of intersects with itself due to this precession. So now, kind of beyond astrophysics, didn't have time to discuss the details of this, but related to this question of cosmic censorship, you know, whether or not you could have singularities where Einstein's theory breaks down that exist outside black hole horizons. It turns out that doesn't actually hold in higher dimensions than you know, our four-dimensional spacetimes that we think describe our universe. So this is actually a case of a black string in five dimensions. So in five or more dimensions, you can get other black objects, you know, black rings, black strings, black Saturns. We have like a sphere and then a toroidal structure. But I guess probably some of you took Ruth Gregory's class, right? So you know all about the Gregory-Laflamme instability that these black strings are subject to. And actually, if you follow the nonlinear development of that instability, you actually find out that you get this pinch off of the black string that would actually result in a naked singularity. So basically, you know, each of these smaller sections also undergoes the Gregory-Laflamme instability, and you just get a cascade of that to smaller scales, but that occurs that sort of you get pinch off in a finite time. And let's just end with this one. So this is the problem of a ultra-relativistic collision. So a concept that people often put in opposition to cosmic censorship is this idea of the Hoop conjecture, which basically says that if we have some, you know, matter and has some mass m, then this matter will form a black hole if and only if we can pass some hoop around this matter in every direction such that the circumference is less than about 4 pi times the mass within that region. So basically, you know, if you plug in what the radius of a black hole is to m, this would saturate this. So the Hoop conjecture doesn't really have a precise statement. There's a squiggle right here. This basically suggests that you know, if you have a very elongated blob of collapsing matter, then it shouldn't form a horizon. And conversely, you shouldn't be able to form sort of arbitrarily elongated black hole horizons. So this last thing I want to talk about is an application of the Hoop conjecture to ultra-relativistic collisions. So imagine you have two objects, each with mass m, and they're moving at ultra-relativistic velocities, which is why I've drawn them to be very Lorentz contracted. And they come and they collide. So at the point of collision, if we calculate the sort of total mass energy, it's going to be 2 times gamma, the Lorentz factor of velocity, times the mass. And then we call this the radius. Basically, when this quantity divided by the radius is comparable to 1/2 by the Hoop conjecture, we should form a black hole. So this sort of is based on the idea that all forms of energy, even kinetic energy, gravitate. And so you should always be able to form a black hole just by colliding things at sufficiently close to the speed of light, where the kinetic energy becomes very large. So this is related to all this hoopla when the LHC first turned on, where people were speculating about forming these tiny black holes. So if you plug in you know, what the energies are you need to, you know, collide protons or something and get a black hole, it's going to be essentially the Planck length, you know, just because the size is sort of set by the de Broglie wavelength of the particles. But, you know, people were speculating about these theories with large extra dimensions where the sort of true Planck scale could be, you know, Planck energies could be much lower, around a few TeV than we thought it could be. And in that case, you can form black holes. But it's just an interesting question. And in general relativity, do you actually form a black hole? And what is the threshold for that? And, you know, it's a little bit mysterious, because if I just apply this hoop conjecture to one of these objects, it doesn't really work, right? Because this is just a boosted spacetime. I can always boost back into a frame where there's not this kinetic energy. But it's really the, you know, collision of these opposing streams of kinetic energy that could form a black hole. So this is a collision here of basically two stars with a Lorentz factor of 10. And you find something pretty interesting happens around the threshold for black hole formation, where you can actually form two separate apparent horizons that then merge into one. And this actually happens at a factor of a few below this threshold that you would get just by using the hoop conjecture. And sort of the explanation you can come over that is, if you, you know, take one of these highly Lorentz contracted objects and just look at sort of geodesics that are coming from the other direction, this kind of acts like a gravitational lens. Like these rays will sort of be focused down to a point and then expand outwards, sort of behind the object. And so there's no reason that this would actually happen. It seems like the stars kind of focus down each other, and so you actually form a somewhat more compact object, which can lower the threshold for black hole formation.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, so that's the end of the class. Happy to stick around to answer any questions.